Chapter 22. Greek Thought in Relation to Human Society. First, the Athens of Pericles. Second, Socrates. Third, Plato and the Academy. Fourth, Aristotle and the Lyceum. Fifth, philosophy becomes unworldly. Sixth, the quality and limitations of Greek thought. First, Greek history for the next 40 years after Plataea and Mycale is a story of comparative peace and tranquillity. There were wars, but they were not intense wars. For a little while in Athens, for a section of the prosperous, there was leisure and opportunity, and by a combination of accidents and through the character of a small group of people, this leisure and opportunity produced the most memorable results. Much beautiful literature was produced, the plastic arts flourished, and the foundations of modern science, already laid by the earlier philosophers of the Ionian Greek cities, were consolidated. Then, after an interlude of 50-odd years, the long smouldering hostility between Athens and Sparta broke out into a fierce and exhausting war, which sapped at last the vitality of this creative movement. This war is known in history as the Peloponnesian War. It went on for nearly 30 years, and wasted all the power of Greece. At first, Athens was in the ascendant, then Sparta. Then arose Thebes, a city not 50 miles from Athens, to overshadow Sparta. Once more, Athens flared into importance as the head of a confederation. It's a story of narrow rivalries and inexplicable hatreds that would have vanished long ago out of the memories of men were it not that it's recorded and reflected in a great literature. Through all this time, Persia appears and reappears as the ally first of this league and then of that. About the middle of the 4th century BC, Greece becomes aware of a new influence in its affairs, that of Philip, king of Macedonia. Macedonia does indeed arise in the background of this incurably divided Greece, as the Medes and Persians arose behind the Chaldean Empire. A time comes when the Greek mind turns round, so to speak, from its disputes, and stares in one united dismay at the Macedonian. Planless and murderous squabbles are still planless and murderous squabbles, even though Thucydides tells the story, even though the great beginnings of a new civilization are wrecked by their disorders. And in this general outline we can give no space at all to the particulars of these internecine feuds, to the fights and flights, that sent first this Greek city and then that up to the sky in flames. Upon a 1-foot globe, Greece becomes a speck almost too small to recognize. And in a short history of mankind, all this century and more of dissension between the days of Salamis and Plataea and the rise of King Philip shrinks to a little, almost inaudible clash of disputation, to a mere note upon the swift passing of opportunity for nations as for men. But what doesn't shrink into insignificance because it has entered into the intellectual process of all subsequent nations, because it's inseparably a part of our mental foundation, is the literature that Greece produced during such patches and gleams of tranquillity and security as these times afforded her. Says Professor Gilbert Murray, "Their outer political history, indeed, like that of all other nations, is filled with war and diplomacy, with cruelty and deceit. It's the inner history, the history of thought and feeling and character, that's so grand. They had some difficulties to contend with, which are now almost out of our path. They had practically no experience, but were doing everything for the first time. They were utterly weak in material resources, and their emotions, their desires and fears and rages, were probably wilder and fiercer than ours, yet they produced the Athens of Pericles and of Plato." This remarkable culmination of the long-gathering creative power of the Greek mind, which for 23 centuries has been to men of intelligence a guiding and inspiring beacon out of the past, flared up after the battles of Marathon and Salamis had made Athens free and fearless, and without any great excesses of power predominant in her world. It was the work of a quite small group of men. A number of her citizens lived for the better part of a generation under conditions which in all ages have disposed men to produce good and beautiful work. They were secure, they were free, and they had pride. And they were without that temptation of apparent and unchallenged power which disposes all of us to inflict wrongs upon our fellow men. When political life narrowed down again to the waste and crimes of a fratricidal war with Sparta, there was so small and well-fed a flame of intellectual activity burning that it lasted through all the windy distresses of this war and beyond the brief lifetime of Alexander the Great for a period altogether of more than 100 years after the wars began. Flushed with victory and the sense of freedom fairly won, the people of Athens did for a time rise towards nobility. Under the guidance of a great demagogue, Pericles, the chief official of the Athenian General Assembly, and a politician-statesman rather of the caliber of Gladstone or Lincoln in modern history, they were set to the task of rebuilding their city and expanding their commerce. For a time they were capable of following a generous leader generously, and fate gave them a generous leader. In Pericles there was mingled, in the strangest fashion, political ability with a real living passion for deep and high and beautiful things. He kept in power for over 30 years. He was a man of extraordinary vigour and liberality of mind. He stamped these qualities upon his time. As Winkler has remarked, the Athenian democracy had for a time the face of Pericles. He was sustained by what was probably a very great and noble friendship. There was a woman of unusual education, Aspasia from Miletus, whom he couldn't marry because of the law that restricted the citizenship of Athens to the home-born, but who was, in effect, his wife. She played a large part in gathering about him men of unusual gifts. All the great writers of the time knew her, and several have praised her wisdom. Plutarch, it's true, accuses her of instigating a troublesome and dangerous but finally successful war against Samos, but as he himself shows later, this was necessitated by the naval hostility of the Samians, which threatened the overseas trade of Athens, upon which all the prosperity of the Republic depended. Men's ambitions are apt to reflect the standards of their intimates. Pericles was content, at any rate, to serve as a leader in Athens rather than to dominate as a tyrant. Alliances were formed under his guidance, new colonies and trading stations were established from Italy to the Black Sea, and the treasures of the League at Delos were brought to Athens. Convinced of his security from Persia, Pericles spent the war hoard of the Allies upon the beautification of his city. This was an unrighteous thing to do by our modern standards, but it wasn't a base or greedy thing to do. Athens had accomplished the work of the Delian League, and is not the labourer worthy of his hire? This sequestration made a time of exceptional opportunity for architects and artists. The Parthenon of Athens, whose ruins are still a thing of beauty, was but the crown set upon the clustering glories of the Athens Pericles rebuilt. Such sculptures as those of Phidias, Myron, and Polycletus that still survive witness to the artistic quality of the time. The reader must bear in mind that illuminating remark of Winkler's, which says that this renascent Athens bore for a time the face of Pericles. It was the peculiar genius of this man and of his atmosphere that let loose the genius of men about him and attracted men of great intellectual vigour to Athens. Athens wore his face for a time as one wears a mask, and then became restless and desired to put him aside. There was very little that was great and generous about the common Athenian. We've told of the spirit of one sample voter for the ostracism of Aristides, and Lloyd, in his Age of Pericles, declares that the Athenians wouldn't suffer the name of Miltiades to be mentioned in connection with the Battle of Marathon. The sturdy self-respect of the common voters revolted presently against the beautiful buildings rising about them, against the favours shown to such sculptors as Phidias over popular worthies in the same line of business, against the donations made to a mere foreigner like Herodotus of Halicarnassus, against the insulting preference of Pericles for the company and conversation of a Milesian woman.
This book is continued on Disc 2.